Okay, so welcome everybody. Upasika Day. today's overall theme is around meditation, and then the topic, developing skill in reflective meditation. As I was mentioning before, the before the meal, we tend to put a lot of effort into trying to not think, and and sometimes our thinking is completely out of control and needs some reining in, but. It's also the case that the Buddha encouraged the skillful use of thought, and in actual fact, and so like the word that is used for thought is vitakka, and generally most often used for thought is vitakka. And there's a few other words that are used as well, but I think probably the most common word for thought is vitakka, and that is also it's a factor of jhana. The first jhana, factor of first jhana, vitakka vichara piti sukha ekagata. But that gives an indication that there are out of control thoughts and there are peaceful focused thoughts, and there's as well as the say the directing of thought or directing of attention to themes of recollection and reflection, the anusatis and is the word that the Buddha uses, and that is themes for recollection, and sort of directing thought to certain themes that are helpful for inspiring the mind or settling the mind or balancing the mind, but it relies on on a that skillful application of the thought process. So I think recognizing that we have to think a bit about what thought actually is, rather than just making assumptions, especially based on our own aversion or fear. Because oftentimes we have certain aversion to thoughts that we don't like, don't approve of, don't want, shouldn't be this way, and that is it tends to. That would just be another source of dukkha. One of the aspects for myself recollecting Ajahn Chah and him describing like the use of lifting up a theme for contemplation or directing attention in a way that settles the mind. Again, using that term vitakka. So it's like lifting up a thought in the mind, lifting up an object of attention into the mind, which is what, the word yoniso manasikara is. And that's Yoniso Manasikara has many translations. The one that, wise reflection, considered attention, those are probably the most common that I know, but there's many, many different skillful thought is another one. But the sense of a wise reflection or yoniso manasikara in Prapayuto's book Buddha Dhamma, there's a whole chapter on yoniso manasikara, and one of the things he says right at the beginning, that wise reflection is a source of nourishment for mindfulness. Say, when thinking proceeds in a systematic, purposeful way, attention does not stray or drift aimlessly. Mindfulness then functions to keep attention on the tasks at hand. So that's a good way of gauging, am I using thought skillfully? These particular thoughts, are they, is it on track? And so that there's this sense of when it helps to nourish mindfulness and helps to keep attention on task, on something useful or beneficial, then that use of that lifting up of thought is a really important source of nourishment and then learning how to pay attention rather than just trying to kind of squelch it or push it aside because it's a thought and I shouldn't be thinking. If I were a real meditator, I wouldn't be thinking. I'd just be in just expanded consciousness at all times. And I don't even know how real that is. The people who I've met who have realization. I mean, they're right there with what they're doing and very present with the world around them and the people around them and with themselves. that sense of sometimes the idea that we kind of graft on to our assumption of what we think we should be doing is kind of it's just that it's an assumption, and I think it's much more, and I think it's much more helpful to be using, of course, which is another object of attention, like using a framework of, especially the Four Noble Truths. That's a really skillful framework for discerning: is this skillful thought, is it not skillful thought? Is it leading to suffering? Is it leading to understanding the causes of suffering? Is it leading to a realization or a experience of the cessation of suffering? Is it supporting the path leading to cessation of suffering? So that's a really helpful framework for coming back and reflecting on thought. And there's a short discourse in the Anguttara Nikaya, and the Buddha says, monks, just as the dawn is the forerunner and precursor of the rising of the sun, so too the fulfillment of wise reflection, yoniso manasikara, is the forerunner and precursor for the arising of the Noble Eightfold Path. It is to be expected, of a monk who has brought wise reflection to completion, that he will develop and cultivate the Noble Eightfold Path. So it's just a very simple statement, but it's really encouraging. And when it says monk, it means a practitioner, a meditator, one who's a seeker. And the and also in terms of themes, and Ajahn Khrun Dhammo, Ajahn Yaniko will be picking up themes as suggestions and guidelines for developing reflective meditations, I think in terms of like choosing a theme, this is where giving oneself the opportunity or leeway to be experimenting and seeing, well, what works, what actually feels meaningful, rather than just following some pattern that is prescribed by somebody else. The Buddha gives a whole range of basically suggestions or encouragements in terms of themes, but we have to pick them up and see how does it affect us? What does it feel like? What's the result? And I think this is where the very practical nature of the Buddha's teachings is kind of paramount. Because if we're just working from a formula that and it feels like we're doing what we're told, and just doing it without really exploring and getting a feel for what the result is, what's how to apply it, how to gain some skill in it, then we're not really going to experience the fruits of the practice. This is where, just in reflection, where the Buddha's description of the Dhamma as open aiko, it's leading inwards. We have to draw it into the heart and get a feel for how it works, how to use it, how to gain skill in using it. And particularly, as meditation, then, so much of meditation is being willing to take an interest in the process of how to make the mind peaceful, how to make the mind clear, how to experience a sense of settling and stability within the mind, within the heart. So that takes one is using these reflective meditations, but then you have to reflect on what its result is. What is it? How to gain some skill in this? of course, in the use of reflective meditations and the use of a directing attention, like yoniso manasikara, like vitakka is sort of more literally sort of thought. Yoniso manasikara is more like a directing of attention or directing the mind to a theme of some sort. But there's one needs to be recollecting is, okay, is there mindfulness and clear comprehension functioning? Is there awareness, and is there a sense of understanding of the purpose, the situation, the benefits and drawbacks, and the sense of am I? Because one of the aspects of clear comprehension is clear comprehension of non-delusion, of not letting that obsession, the me obsession, take over, because that's and we've all experienced that, where we're meditating, trying to make our minds peaceful and clear, and there's just so much me involved that it's not a very satisfying result, and so it's learning. That's an aspect of clear comprehension, aspect of mindfulness. How much me is getting involved, and of course it isn't as if you sort of abdicate any responsibility this is where the middle way of the Buddha's is. Yeah, there's some finesse and subtlety that's required, and that takes this developing of reflection, reflective directing of attention, and then a reflective assessment of what are the results. So there's one has to apply the thought processes, and and that is a useful I think it's important to keep reminding ourselves that is what it does require that engagement. And sometimes that engagement the mind starts spinning and starts proliferating and starts spinning out on things, and then you say, okay, well that's definitely not useful, and there's a certain humility that's needed of in a sense. Yeah, okay, my mind is really out of control. Okay, start over, come back, and not take it too personally, too seriously. There's a writer, Anne Lamott, who said, something like, my mind is like a bad neighborhood. I don't want to go there alone, So it's we need the different supports of in our practice in order to sometimes our mind's a mess, and so it's learning how to develop the skillful props and supports, and of course that's where directing attention to say refuges, Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, to confidence, faith, loving kindness, compassion. Those are thoughts of loving kindness, thoughts of compassion, and those are when we direct attention in that way, then we are there, that supportive. They are thought processes, but they're extremely supportive. Or sometimes they're like lifting up thoughts of reminders of death. And like sometimes like you need to sort of shake the system to get out of our obsessions. You're talking to yourself sometimes. What are you doing? Wasting time with these obsessions and petty crap. You're going to die, and quit wasting time. Sometimes you have to just be a bit forceful. It's not. It's a series of paying attention to what the result is and what is actually needed. so say one does use as an application of mindfulness and discernment and other spiritual faculties to interrupt the flow of habitual thinking that ends up in what's unskillful or unwholesome, and it's really important to pay attention to those little breaks when that process is interrupted, the habitual process of our obsessive thoughts, and then to pay attention to when that is interrupted or when it settles. Because oftentimes what happens is, and we actually are experiencing that all the time, but we don't pay attention to it. So it's like, so it isn't as if we're just completely swept up in obsessive, demented thinking. I mean, it's just that comes and goes, when we do create a kind of a gap, we oftentimes don't pay attention. So that's lifting that up and paying attention to it. That is a skillful application of thought and directing of the thought processes as well, of where does it cease? Where does it settle? And that getting a feel for the flavor of that. So those are maybe some thoughts to begin the afternoon, and just open it up for questions. Have a bit of, and before passing it on to Ajahn Kurundamo. To any, yeah.
When you say lifting up, are you during meditation a certain object of attention, or are you referring to lifting up?
Yes, it's like lifting up where there's a, yeah, again, where either there might be some restlessness where the mind is. Trapped in some kind of restless thinking, obsessive thinking, or it's kind of sinking. So then just lifting up a thought, a reminder of say some aspect of Dhamma or some object of attention, impermanence, recollection it was like the other, when I first get back, onto the one prat night, I gave a talk, and it was, part of it was around using a phrase that Ajahn Chah had used he used the Pali, Namo Vijnana Dhatu, and it was sort of a homage to the element of consciousness, and I talked in various ways about that, and then Ajahn Yaniko said, and then I was really, I mean, I just got off, just come back from England, so I was kind of spaced out, and went back and went to bed. Ajahn Yaniko said, no, I said, oh, that was really useful last night during the vigil meditation, brought up that phrase, homage to the consciousness element, just as a good reminder. It's like you're lifting up a thought, paying attention to the quality of knowing. So one that's an example where you're lifting up a theme that might be helping the mind, or that reminder what's my posture doing? How am I? Because usually we're trying to figure out the mind and say, what's my posture doing? Am I sitting comfortably? Am I present here? And that's using a recollection, a reminder. Okay, that's a thought that helps to lift up energy and come back into the present moment. Or using different themes. I mean, there's lots to choose from.
Just a question regarding the purpose of lifting up a theme, intention with it. You mentioned to settle, to balance the mind.
Yeah.
Is there ever to have a deeper understanding or more insight?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, no. I mean, it's like that. You pick up a theme to explore it, but then to have a deeper insight, there does need to be one. It has to hit the mind, hit the heart, so that there's both a kind of settling, but then an exploration of going into it, and one can do that of letting go, relinquishing, abandoning. Am I actually abandoning the causes of dukkha? What is the nature of this causal process? And it's like with is that like dependent origination is a theme of exploration, where you say what's that causal process? What are the conditions that support this? Say the mind spinning out. What are the conditions that allow the mind to let go, to relinquish, to understand that, so that one is seeing it not as an identity, but as a non-self process that is playing itself out, that we can understand and free ourselves from. So there's lots of ways. It's like how we explore it, how we apply it we have to see how it hits the heart. And sometimes something worked last week and makes nothing this week, no impact. Sometimes you hit something, it's really fresh and one can really engage in it for many days, weeks, months even, and it's really meaningful. But I think certainly in terms of exploring the insight into Dhamma, one isn't trying to figure absolutely everything out, but just understanding the patterns. Like you think, the Buddha's description of liberating insight that is most frequently mentioned in the suttas is whatever of it is of the nature to arise, that is of the nature to cease. And you think, okay. That's not that difficult. But we keep missing it. And we keep we get caught up in our habitual patterns, so we keep layering it over with assumptions and projections, and we realize, oh no, this is a doorway into releasing and relinquishing.
Is it okay to go the other way? In terms of you have some suffering in your life, an interaction with a coworker, yep, a family member, and then to use that incident to explore your habitual patterns?
Oh, absolutely. 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 And oftentimes, I mean, that's First Noble Truth, suffering. And it gets our attention. And there's some motivation there. That suffering hurts. And we keep doing it. And so then that recollection of suffering is a, you know, when we really, again, not personalizing it, not identify, you know, creating a, oh, poor me, or old suffering me, here I go again. But this is suffering. And then it opens up, seeing the pattern, seeing the processes, as then when we're willing to see it as a process, and we can step out of the identification with.
Mm-hmm. Is that related to sort of the looking for the fading away?
Yes, yes. Yeah, that would be related to fading away, related to nirodha, cessation. Which is, say, cessation of suffering. Even if it, you know, it's just realizing that, one, it's just not, it isn't as if it's constant. But it's those gaps that we miss. It's those times that we actually do relinquish and release that we miss, because we haven't directed our attention to it. And when we don't, then we don't get a feel for it, and then we don't gain confidence in it. We don't have faith in it. And we're looking for something else.
So we're not looking at the blank, we're looking at the transition.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Yeah, it's not just, not looking at the blank, not trying to make it all blank, as if there's nothing there. Because even, so like when the Buddha speaks of emptiness, it's always an empty of something. It's not a metaphysical emptiness, which is kind of a later Buddhist kind of extrapolation, as if there's some kind of solid metaphysical emptiness that you somehow merge with or whatever. But it's an emptiness of a something. This room is emptiness of is empty of elephants and horses. I mean, it's and then you start saying, well, this mind is empty of particular thoughts of aversion or ill will or confusion. So, pay attention to that. And then, ultimately, one is what the Buddha is pointing to in terms of, say, the emptiness that is transformative is the emptiness of there isn't a self inserting itself there. This is different. This is peaceful. Yeah.
Object. So then how did this, I'm trying to understand, I recently went to a Zen gathering. And
right.
My basic understanding is they're not
not focusing on the Four Noble Truths. They're trying to be, you know, present in the moment.
Yeah.
And to get to some sort of no mind state. How did this arise, and why is that considered Buddhism?
This is being recorded. I mean, it's a lot of how it's used, and it's something that is I think in terms of the way that, I mean, I don't understand the history completely, and it is a progression in Buddhist philosophy and the teaching, and it did say emptiness took on a almost like a metaphysical entity like experience or configuration somehow. And you know, I think the Buddha was, I mean, he was extremely practical and wasn't, he was trying to give tools that are helpful. And sometimes, and certainly with the Four Noble Truths are really essential to the understanding of Buddhism. And I remember one time going to pay respects to a highly revered Dzogchen master, sort of Tibetan tradition, and of course they've certainly have that element of kind of the emptiness but he in his teaching that day, something that he said really, really hit me, because one, he was one of His Holiness the Dalai Lama's meditation teachers. He was the preceptor for the whole of the Nyingma lineage, for their ordained sangha, and a teacher of many of the great Dzogchen masters who are around these days, and he said, you know, for whatever teachings that you hear, then if they don't fit into or fulfill the Four Noble Truths, then it's just not Buddhism. And I think that's a teaching that really goes through all of the different lineages and I'm not sure what, you know, Zen, of course, is a very broad category of teachings from the Japanese tradition, but I think any of those teachings would be, you know, you have to come back to the Four Noble Truths as a basic foundation. And you know, you can use all sorts of different tools and use different approaches, but those four noble truths are really essential.
You mentioned before the meal about bhavana, the definition of it as bringing into being.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to weigh that a little bit, you know, which direction to go, what I'm bringing into being.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I feel like I don't know how much to balance making the mind peaceful.
Mm-hmm.
Making the mind clear, and I know it's related. kind of a question of, you know, concentration or insight.
Right. Yeah, and I think one of the things is, again, it's just using the tangible result or experience. Because when we say suffering as dukkha and the First Noble Truth, it isn't just sort of sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. Emotional level, it's all of the shaking of the mind, the movement of the mind to reestablish itself, to look for something else. Just that movement itself, that's dukkha. The mind isn't content, the heart isn't content. So it's just being able to recognize, and then looking at well, what can I bring into being that helps the mind to say, and you know, really in the time of the Buddha, there wasn't much of a separation between like nowadays there's a lot of talk of like, oh, this is samatha, this is sort of tranquility and peacefulness that you're, and meditative stillness, and then there's insight, as if they're two different things. And they're really not. They're really absolutely interconnected and interrelated. And so then anything that helps to bring about a sense of, clarity or clarifying one's theme of reflection or one's experience. I mean, there's an insight into that. But correspondingly, the mind will settle. And similarly, when there's awareness along with the settling, and I think that it is, because sometimes we settle the mind, we look for the mind to be peaceful, and that's where we find ourselves drifting into sometimes dullness, or even if the mind is peaceful and even quite clear, but it's not very agile. And there's an agility of the mind that is also part and parcel of the process of liberating the heart and awakening. Yeah, so you're testing those, reflecting on those.
Yeah, thank you. That's helpful. Yeah. I think when I have an unhelpful state of mind, I can use things to sort of calm the mind and focus.
Yeah.
I don't feel I've really learned anything as soon as I come out of that.
Mm-hmm.
It's still going to get me.
Yeah, well, sometimes that just being willing to be patient with oneself and not investing too much into the identity of me and my same old defilements, you know. More fundamental, yeah, more fundamental. That was sort of like, that's your doorway into a release and awakening. Okay, so maybe we'll pass on to Ajahn Khrunadhammo.
Bringing us back and continuing on with the theme of the day on reflective meditations, I thought that I'd start with a sutta that I think, for me, when I read it a number of years ago, was very meaningful in that it brought up a few of these kinds of reflections that we're talking about, more of the active kinds of reflections. And, well, I'll just go ahead and read it first and then kind of make a few comments on it. It was on the reading list for this day. So some of you may have taken a look at it. It's from the, it's in two places that I know of. The one that I've got here is from the Numerical Discourses of the Buddha, the Anguttara Nikaya, the Book of the Nines. It's also, this sutta is also found in the Udana, one of the other parts of the Sutta Pitaka. And it's a discourse that takes place with a monk whose name is Meghya. I'll just go ahead and read it and we'll go from there. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Chalika, on Mount Chalika. Now on that occasion, the Venerable Meghya was the Blessed One's attendant. Then the Venerable Meghya approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, stood to one side, and said to him, Bhante, I would like to enter Jantugama for alms. You may do so, Meghya, at your own convenience. Then in the morning, the Venerable Meghya dressed, took his bowl and robe, and entered Jantugama for alms. When he had walked for alms, after his meal, on returning from his alms round, he went to the bank of the Kimikala River. As he was walking and wandering around for exercise along the bank of the Kimikala River, the Venerable Meghya saw a lovely and delightful mango grove. It occurred to him, this mango grove is truly lovely and delightful, suitable for the striving of a clansman intent on striving. If the Blessed One permits me, I will come back to this mango grove to strive. Then the Venerable Meghya approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, sat down to one side, and said, this morning, Bhante, I dressed, took my bowl and robe, and entered Jantugama for alms. And goes through that same recitation of what I just read. So if the Blessed One would permit me, I will go back to that mango grove to strive. And the Buddha replies to him, as we are alone, Meghya, wait until another bhikkhu comes along. So he was the Buddha's attendant, and the Buddha was saying, well, hang on, you know, don't go wandering off yet. But the Venerable Meghya is persistent. He makes the same request a second time. The Buddha replies the same, wait until another bhikkhu comes along. Venerable Meghya is not to be daunted, asks for a third time. And then the Buddha replies, since you speak of striving, Meghya, what can I say to you? You may go at your own convenience. Then the Venerable Meghya rose from his seat, paid homage to the Blessed One, circumambulated him, keeping the right side toward him, and went to the mango grove. He entered and sat down at the foot of a tree to pass the day. Then, while the Venerable Meghya was dwelling in that mango grove, three kinds of bad, unwholesome thoughts frequently occurred to him: sensual thoughts, thoughts of ill will, and thoughts of harming. It then occurred to him, this is truly astounding and amazing. I have gone forth out of faith from the household life into homelessness. Yet I am still stalked by these three kinds of bad, unwholesome thoughts: sensual thoughts, thoughts of ill will, and thoughts of harming. Then the Venerable Meghya approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, sat down to one side, and said, here, Bhante, while I was dwelling in that mango grove, the three kinds of bad, unwholesome thoughts frequently occurred to me. He repeats that. And then the Buddha replies, Meghya, when liberation of mind has not matured, five things lead to its maturation. What five? So in a sense, in essence, he's saying, I tried to warn you. And Meghya didn't listen. And this is actually really pertinent because we see that all the time. You know, people who, through their own overestimation, feel like they're just, you know, ready to go and jump into deep solitude and in a few days, hopefully they'll, you know, become perfectly enlightened. And, you know, the Buddha's saying, well, there's a little bit more preparation that needs to be done before, you know, you're ready for this kind of thing. So here he offers, he says, when liberation of mind has not matured, five things lead to its maturation. What five? One, here, Meghya, a bhikkhu has good friends, good companions, good comrades. When liberation of mind has not matured, this is the first thing that leads to its maturation.
Number two, again, a bhikkhu is virtuous. He dwells restrained by the patimokkha, possessed of good conduct and resort, seeing danger in minute faults. Having undertaken the training rules, he trains in them. When liberation of mind has not matured, this is the second thing that leads to its maturation. The equivalent for people who aren't ordained is following the precepts, maintaining a virtuous set of precepts. Three, again, a bhikkhu gets to hear at will, without trouble or difficulty, talk concerned with the austere life that is conducive to opening up the heart. That is, talk on fewness of desires, on contentment, on solitude, on not getting bound up with others, on arousing energy, on virtuous behavior, on concentration, wisdom, liberation, on the knowledge and vision of liberation. When liberation of mind has not matured, this is the third thing that leads to its maturation. Four, again, a bhikkhu has aroused energy for abandoning unwholesome qualities and acquiring wholesome qualities. He is strong, firm in exertion, not casting off the duty of cultivating wholesome qualities. When liberation of mind has not matured, this is the fourth thing that leads to its maturation. Five, again, a bhikkhu is wise. He possesses the wisdom that discerns arising and passing away, which is noble and penetrative and leads to the complete destruction of suffering. When liberation of mind has not matured, this is the fifth thing that leads to its maturation. And then setting up those five skillful activities, the Buddha says, having based himself on these five things, the bhikkhu should develop further another four things. One, the perception of unattractiveness should be developed to abandon lust. That's asubha practice. Loving kindness should be developed to abandon ill will. Mindfulness of breathing should be developed to cut off thoughts. The perception of impermanence should be developed to eradicate the conceit, I am. When one perceives impermanence, the perception of not-self is stabilized. One who perceives not-self eradicates the conceit, I am, which is nibbana in this very life. So I really, when I first read that, I thought, well, if nothing more, those four kinds of practice, those four kinds of reflections could... One could spend a whole lifetime just with those, developing the practice. Because the four that he talked about developing to Meghia as these are four things that are good for your toolkit. We're trying to develop this toolkit of contemplations or reflections because our mind isn't always the same. We have different things come up in the mind. Sometimes there's anger coming up, aversion. Sometimes there's sensual desire that's distracting. Sometimes there's just the general overall delusion and confusion of our lives. But these four things seem to have a very broad brush application, so that we have loving kindness, the asubha practice, perception, developing the perception of the unattractive. We have just the mindfulness of breathing, and we have the contemplation on arising and passing away, or anicca. Anicca-sanya, the perception of impermanence. And if you think about it, you know, the three roots of suffering, the three unwholesome roots of suffering, lobha, dosa, moha, greed, hatred, delusion, or, greed, anger, aversion, confusion, those are all, at least given... some chance to apply some antidotes. So you've got the for lobha, greed. You have the reflection on the unattractive, the asubha practice, which, as many of you know, involves things like contemplation of the 32 parts of the body to be able to see the true nature of what it is that we normally label as alluring, desirable, attractive. So we develop a reflection on. Its opposite, to be able to balance that state of mind that is wrapped up in sensual desire.
We have a contemplation, a very active contemplation on metta bhavana, development of loving kindness to help start to balance out and act as an antidote to the mind that has anger or aversion in it. The contemplation of impermanence, anicca sanya, is to help us counteract that the delusion, the moha, that is one of the root causes of suffering and acts as a base for development of wisdom, discernment. And then the contemplation on the mindfulness of breathing is kind of an overall contemplation that also helps to settle, clarify, and bring a sense of both alertness and calmness to the mind to be able to see all of these other practices. So those four contemplations that he gave to Meghia, I thought, well, if I don't develop anything other than these four things in this lifetime, it will be a life well spent, because it really does attack many different angles. And a lot of these contemplations that we talk about, and we'll talk about a little bit later on, Lopal referred to a few of them, like contemplation of death, and other ways that we can skillfully use our attention. They're part of this toolkit that we can have, so that when our mind is colored by one defilement, we can apply a certain reflection, an active reflection. When it's confused by some other defilement, we have yet another tool in our toolkit that we can refer to. So it's developing over a lifetime, developing a set of skills so that as we evaluate what it is that is happening, we can have ways to approach that are skillful. So I thought that maybe just to take one of those, there's part of me that was tempted to go into the asubha practice because I find that a very useful one and one that's often misunderstood. But I think that for today and for a shorter period, probably have to save that for another time, and thought that maybe just to offer a few reflections on metta bhavana, loving kindness, and maybe to do a bit of a guided meditation with that and to spend a bit of time, just because... not that we're all, consumed with anger and hostility all the time, and we need to develop this as a countermeasure, although that is a possibility. But also just because loving kindness, the reflection on loving kindness, is a very, very one of the most exalted, wholesome states of mind that one can actively construct. It is a constructed state of mind. It's a created, conditioned state of mind, fabricated state of mind, if you will. But it's one that is so skillful in that it's so broad and receptive and kind of fulfills many of the qualities that are described as sama samadhi, right concentration. That, and for me anyway, it's a very accessible one that just through, after developing familiarity with, is something that can be brought into awareness and brought into consciousness fairly easily with the use of just a few words, a few reflections, a few mental images. And to me is something that is often much more easily accessible during the day when we're interacting with other people, when you only have a short period of time. You don't have to go find a quiet place, get out of everybody's way, a quiet room, and sit down for 45 minutes to do it. It's as one of our reflections says, that it should be practiced all the time in all postures. It's the sublime abiding. To hold on to in any circumstance. So I find that the more I develop this practice, the more easy it is to kind of move into a state
of clarity and openness and alertness that is quite easily accessible. So, metta bhavana, many of you have probably practiced it along some of the traditional lines that has been taught, particularly as the meditation practices have come to the West. And a lot of those teachings using recitation of phrases like, may I be well, may I be happy, may I be free from suffering, those kinds of verbal reflections, first to oneself, then to, say, one who could be seen as a benefactor or someone you feel close to, someone you have a sense of fondness for, appreciation for, then to a neutral person, then to somebody who you have conflict with, and that constant broadening of the sphere of people for whom you send this reflection of goodwill and well-wishing. That's a very traditional approach to how it's been taught, and that comes from the commentaries primarily. The Buddha is a bit more... he doesn't go into a lot of detail in the actual suttas about the development of this. He talks certainly about it, but more in describing the quality of that metta and the four Brahma Viharas, metta, karuna, upeka, and mudita. He talks about the qualities and about developing an expansive mind that is imbued with these qualities, but kind of leaves it more or less at that, except for the Metta Sutta. He talks a little bit more in detail about the qualities, but that actual technique is more commentarial. And over the years, I've found that particular approach has been a bit helpful, but sometimes gets to be a bit busy. I don't know how many of you have actually picked it up as a practice, but for me, that kind of picking up and constant recitation of words in my head sometimes gets to be a bit strained, and I don't really get a lot of settled collectedness from that kind of approach. So based on some of the teachings of other monks and reflections that I've gone through myself, I've found for myself a kind of a more simple way, because what we're trying to access is that feeling of warmth, that feeling of gentleness, that feeling of kindness towards ourselves and towards other people, and find that it's more useful to firmly establish that in myself, in my own sphere of awareness, my own sphere of consciousness, and then to gradually let that space expand outwards and mentally invite others into that space, rather than like sending out beams of metta to all these other beings and the world around me, kind of that kind of pushing it out into the world. More just keeping that firm, established sense of kindness, gentleness, well-wishing, right here, and letting that awareness open, expand, and then visually or mentally with suggestion, invite others slowly into that space so that you're never losing your own balance, you're never losing your own center, you're never getting lost out there in, you know, trying to make sure that everybody's feeling your metta, pushing your metta out on everybody. I thought that I'd just maybe do a little bit of a guided meditation, then we can kind of experiment with that a little bit for 20 minutes or so and see where it takes us. And again, this is a very active kind of contemplation, and this is not just sitting there passively and, you know, waiting for something to happen. This is cultivation. You know, when you think of cultivation, you're actually doing something. You're tilling the field, you're planting seeds, you're encouraging things to wholesome states to grow. So let's find a comfortable position for a few minutes of meditation.
The way I'm going to guide this meditation is really essentially one that I've worked on developing for myself. And I just want to emphasize that that process of actually getting to feel what this quality of metta actually feels like in the body, feels like in the heart, is the most essential thing. And you might use some of my images and words, or you might develop your own. In fact, developing your own is the best way to do it after experimenting, because each of us has our own images and triggers and thoughts that are best suited to us and our temperament. So this is just offered as an example of an approach. So to sit quietly for a minute and just, first of all, get settled into the body. The body is always the base of experience for me as I start meditation. Just feel the groundedness of solidity of this, the body's earth element. Feeling the density of the legs and the torso, the arms, the head and neck. It's one whole unit of earth element, groundedness, right here in the body. Now see if you can bring up a memory or a visualization of a particular person or event where someone showed you some kindness or some compassion, helped you maybe through a difficult time, gave you some attention when you were sorely in need of it. Someone's act of kindness towards you. See if you can bring something like that up to your mind. If you can bring that up and really allow yourself to absorb into the feeling that comes from that. You feel a sense of, and you have to come up with your own label, but warmth or appreciation, peacefulness, fondness, kindness. What does that feel like in the body? Or maybe there was a time when someone else was experiencing a difficult or vulnerable moment and entrusted you with their difficulties, and you were able to listen, support, help them. What did that feel like? What does that feel like in that memory?
Or if it's difficult finding a memory of a human interaction, some of our best moments of opening and warmth and love come from creatures that aren't human, like a little kitten or a big old dog with its head in your lap kind of staring at you with big brown eyes, with that kind of unconditional love that that an old dog has. What does that image bring up? And if it helps to bring up a simple phrase like imagining that being in your sphere of awareness, to send well wishing, if it helps to say, may you be well, may you be happy, thank you with gratitude, then use that. And if it feels good just to sit there with the feeling in your heart, that's really what we're looking for. To just dwell with and encourage and nurture that sense of peace, warmth, caring, kindness. Just let that settle and be pervasive through the body as you breathe. If that feeling is well established, you can just dwell with that and breathing it in and breathing it out, but encouraging its presence and refreshing its presence. You might need to bring up the image that you found most effective again. Allow your sphere of awareness to expand just a little bit, making sure that it's first throughout your whole body, with each in-breath and out-breath, gradually expanding a sphere of awareness that's imbued with this quality of kindness, gentleness, warmth. Seeing if that sphere of awareness can extend just a little bit beyond the edges of the body. See if your sphere of awareness can open up and expand to include this whole room that we're in. And offer the invitation for all the beings in this room to be dwelling with you in that sphere of gentle warmth, kindness. Just noticing the quality of that feeling still within your body. See if you can think of just one word that describes it. That describes the actual experience. You have to find your own word, but again, some of the words that might be partially descriptive are something like gentle, warm, peaceful, caring. And really associate the feeling with that one word. If that sense, that metta feeling, it feels fairly stable, feel free to mentally invite beings who aren't in this room into this space. Either people you are close to, or even if it feels quite solid, to invite people who you've had difficulties with into this room, into this space of kindness. Just to sit with us in this space. Imagine that they're in here with us. If that metta feeling starts to fade, you can always return to that original image to rekindle it.
So we'll leave it at that point, but just to realize that that expanding consciousness, that expanding boundaries can go as far as you want it to go. But to close it, bring your attention back just to this physical body, presence of this body sitting here, breathing in and out. And allow yourself to slowly feel the residual of that practice to whatever extent it's there. And then to slowly bring the meditation contemplation to a close as you open your eyes. Come back into the room here. So yeah, just an example of one way to apply a contemplation using a very specific theme to really purposefully direct the mind and developing a skillful quality in meditation. Anybody have any comments or questions about this?
Matthew.
Did Buddha ever say to send loving kindness to oneself?
Yes, maybe not using those specific words, but the kind of the most often phrasing that he used in describing the Brahmaviharas, you can find it in our chanting book. We actually do it as a regular chant, and you see it in a number of different places in the suttas. It goes through all the Brahmaviharas, but it's just one simple recitation applied to all four of those. And it's may I abide pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with loving kindness. Likewise, the second, the third, the fourth, above and below, around and everywhere, and to all as to myself. I will abide pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility, without ill will. So that's pretty much the most direct statement that he gives, and then he goes through the other three Brahmaviharas in that same formula. But what has always struck me about that is, again, that he's saying, may I abide, or I will abide, pervading one quarter with the mind that's imbued with this quality, implying that you've imbued your heart, you've imbued your mind with this quality, and then you expand and open your heart to a greater sphere, first one quarter, second quarter, third quarter, fourth quarter, above, below, around, everywhere, so that you've established the quality in your heart, and then you expand the range of your awareness to bring other beings into that sphere that's already imbued with that quality of kindness. But he makes a very explicit point: as to all is to myself. So it's very important that we keep this perception of who we are right at the center of that, right in that. That sphere of kindness. Or compassion, or altruistic joy, or equanimity.
What would you use with somebody who's can get extremely confused and angry? It just seems like loving kindness seems so kind of far away. Is there something closer to them that can be used?
You're talking about what can be used to help them, or what can be used to help you cope with them?
Both.
Yeah. Well, I think you start with the second one of those two that I just mentioned first. You start with that developing just, as, you know, like through this reflection that I just talked about. You develop the sense of well-being, of wishing well, of kindness inside your own heart. And you have to make that firmly established. Just keeping it very simple with an image or a thought that you know is foolproof in bringing up that sense of metta inside of yourself. And then you just establish that firmly. Then, you know, when that feels quite well established and clear for in your own experience, in your own heart, then you can establish that image of that difficult person, that person who is having difficulty, who is maybe wrapped up in anger. You just bring them into that sphere, your own sphere of kindness. And if it's established firmly enough, that the presence, the mental presence, the image of that other person, you know, it may cause a little bit of a wavering, but the strength of a well-developed heart, mind of kindness is so strong that it can hold that and not waver. And then just to stay with that. You don't have to send it out to that person. You don't have to hope that that person receives the benefit from it. But you're just holding that person with all of their difficulties in that sphere of awareness that you've established with kindness. And then if you actually encounter them in real life, or if you have a real life interaction with them, if you can just keep that centered experience of kindness in your own sphere of awareness, and that's the best thing you can do for them. Because if you're interacting with them, you'll be interacting with them with a heart of kindness. And your responses will be dictated by that heart of kindness rather than trying to make them feel any differently, trying to solve their problems, trying to make them a happier person. You know, it usually doesn't work very easily that way. Yeah. But we can have a wish for that or a hope, you know, for that. But the most important thing is maintaining that sense of balance, caring inside of yourself so that it is unshakable in the presence of somebody else who, you know, isn't experiencing that or is experiencing something really painful or difficult. So your own solidity, your own confidence, your own presence of mind is the best thing that you can offer them. And then they have to work it out. You know, if they come to you and are asking for help or expressing something, then you can respond in the moment with your own wisdom that's based on that true experience of kindness. You know, and the appropriate response will come out. You don't have to program it. You don't have to plan it. You don't have to think about it too much. It's just, if you're solid with that, then it becomes a much more natural response. And then it's up to them to receive it or not. Does that make some sense?
Yeah, it does. But if you, like, you know, lose that firm sense, would you suggest maybe how to reestablish it? Or would you develop a word or something to establish it?
Yeah, and that's kind of like the approach I was describing, is if you can find an image or a word that represents that feeling, then with practice over time, you can just say that word, even in a moment, you know, in a challenging moment, or bring up that image in a challenging moment. And fairly quickly, again, you know, it takes some cultivation, but fairly quickly, bring up that sense of that actual feeling, that actual bodily experience of whatever word you're using to describe it. And sometimes, you know, if you're really in the onslaught, if there's, you know, if it's like the heat of the moment and somebody's really coming at you, you might have to, you know, politely withdraw, you know, and actually not be there. You know, you might have to excuse yourself, say, I'm sorry, you know, I need to be by myself for a while to reestablish that before you can, you know, if your skill isn't quite honed enough to do it in the moment. But it is, it's just a matter of practicing it and using those tag words or those tag images that immediately induce the feeling. And you can do that, but it does take cultivation when you're not in the heat of the moment.
Right.
Yeah. It's like now, like one of my key words is gentle. That's just a word that I like. And, you know, if I'm walking down the courtyard and I see somebody who, you know, might have some problems or some issues, and I, you know, see that, oh, okay, well, something, or I hear the knock on the door, you know, and I can see through the shaded image who's out there, and I know they're having some difficulty or something. That's sort of like, I can say that word to myself before they come in the room or before I encounter them in the walkway, and kind of, oh, okay, gentle, and then be able to receive whatever it is that's coming my way a little more easily.
Well, that's helpful, because loving kindness seems so
conceptual and big. Yeah, yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, yeah. So you have to come up with a word that really describes for yourself what it feels like. Okay, well, I think it's time for a break.